From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, is the men's movement in conflict with the women's movement? We put this question to Robert Bly, one of the founders of the men's movement and the author of its most influential book, Iron John. Also today, we talk with Korean-American journalist John Lee about racial tensions between African-Americans and Korean-Americans in Los Angeles. Lee writes for the Los Angeles Times. And book critic John Leonard has a review of Dan Wakefield's new memoir, New York in the 50s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Congress is close to passing an aid package designed to help the victims of the Los Angeles riots and of the flooding in Chicago. The House is expected to vote on the measure Thursday. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Congressional leaders met with President Bush today at the White House and agreed on general steps to improve the conditions of the nation's inner cities. Although congressional Democrats and the president said they would put aside partisan differences to reach consensus on housing, job training, and economic development programs, the two sides disagreed over how much money should be spent and where it should come from. The House is nearing a vote on an emergency aid package, which would provide $800 million in business loans and disaster relief for Los Angeles and Chicago. The president and lawmakers are eager to move quickly in response to the recent riots and flooding. Voters have made it clear in recent primaries that they're disgusted with the political gridlock in Washington by bouncing out entrenched incumbents and supporting candidates who are considered to be outside of the political system. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The hastily formed task force called Rebuild Los Angeles says as many as 3,000 offers of help have come in during the group's first 10 days of operation. The riots in L.A. were the most damaging in the United States this century. More than 50 people died in the violence, while damage estimates are projected to top $1 billion. The task force says the offers of help have come despite the lack of a published phone number for Rebuild L.A. The group is headed by Peter Ueberroth, former baseball commissioner and head of the 1984 Summer Olympic Organizing Committee. CIA Director Robert Gates today told Congress that a 110-page file on Lee Harvey Oswald will be declassified and sent to the National Archives any day now. That, he said, would be the first step in a policy of greater openness on the John F. Kennedy assassination. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Director Gates brought the file with him. It covers Oswald's activities before the assassination, including his defection to the Soviet Union in 1959. Director Gates said there would be only minor deletions in the public version. Quote, "I believe that maximum disclosure will discredit the theory that CIA had anything to do with the murder of John F. Kennedy." But both Gates and FBI Director William Sessions opposed a proposed bill mandating prompt release of the material because they said it compromised the president's authority to control executive branch documents. Under questioning, Deputy Assistant Attorney General David Leach confirmed that the administration is considering an executive order directing federal agencies to declassify and release information relating to the Kennedy murder. Committee Chairman John Glenn of Ohio said that sounded like an attempt to preempt legislation. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Stocks fell on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 12 points to close at 3385.12. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Washington, D.C. Mayor Sharon Pratt Kelly says condoms will be made available to high school students and prison inmates in the city as a way to fight AIDS. She has also endorsed a trial program to give hypodermic needles to drug abusers. Health officials say the rate of HIV infection in the District of Columbia is more than six times that of the rest of the nation. It is expected to increase. Under the mayor's plan, condoms will be dispensed to teenagers by school nurses who will also offer counseling about sexual abstinence. The Tennessee Valley Authority today announced it has bought pollution rights from Wisconsin Power and Light Company. This first-time agreement under the Federal Clean Air Act allows the TVA to release more acid rain-producing chemicals than it otherwise would be allowed. Wisconsin Public Radio Steve Buscalaki has more.
Wisconsin Power and Light has exceeded federal goals of reducing sulfur dioxide emissions. TVA, on the other hand, is one of the biggest producers of that chemical. Under the deal, WPL sold its emission credits to TVA, giving the Tennessee utility more time to achieve national compliance with federal cleanup rules. Utility officials would not disclose the price of the contract, but said it was worth somewhere between $2.5 and $4 million. Environmental leaders in Wisconsin call the agreement ludicrous because it allows utilities to buy the right to move pollution from one part of the country to another. But TVA's William Malik says it's a good deal for everyone. Wisconsin ratepayers should see stable utility prices, and TVA will have more time to cut emissions in a cost-efficient way for its ratepayers. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Buzalaki in Madison.
The American Automobile Association says the national average gasoline price is going up. AAA says the average price of a gallon of self-serve regular unleaded gas is $1.12. That's the highest price since December. Prices were up in all regions of the country. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Poet Robert Bly is one of the founders of the men's movement and the author of its most influential book, Iron John, which has just come out in paperback. He writes, "It is clear to men that the images of adult manhood given by the popular culture are worn out. A man can no longer depend on them." Bly has led many men's groups in which he's offered alternative images of men based on myth, fairy tales, and tribal initiation rites. He says in response to the women's movement, many men developed the part of themselves Bly calls the soft male, gentle but lacking in vitality and resolve. He works with men to develop what he calls the wild man. Bly also speaks of the grief men feel throughout their lives because they were never close enough to their fathers. Their fathers were out making a living, leaving the sons without a strong male guide. Bly has been leading men's groups for about a decade. I asked him about the changes the men's movement has gone through.
Of course, no one goes into talking about gender if they really want to be liked. So quite a bit of opposition has appeared to it, which surprised me a lot. And you can say that the mind of the media is still 20 years out of date. It really wants fights between men and women. And the purpose of the men's thing has always been that when the men go into a place with more soul and come into some of the grief they have with their father, the enmity between men and women goes down.
How has being in the men's movement changed your life? Do you feel that you have been able to reconcile things about your father or that you've developed personally in any way as a result?
Well, I gave seminars and lectures for a long time on the matriarchies and on the goddess. And it was only 8 or 9 years ago that I began doing some work with men. And it corresponded really to a time when I decided I finally had to do some thinking and work and feeling with my father. So I think being able to talk to whole groups of men about my own grief with my father and have them respond with theirs was tremendously helpful to me.
And the cause of the problem with your father had to do with several things. One was that he was an alcoholic, and the other was that he was, pretty non-communicative, I take it.
Yeah, that's right.
So you felt that you never, as a young man, had a real father-son relationship with him.
Well, it's hard to say about that. My feeling is that I loved him tremendously when I was maybe 1 to 3 to 4 years old. After that, then I think that I was, I agreed with my mother that I would be on her side. And there was a lot of pain that she went through. And so I think it happened to many, many men that they made a decision not to be a companion of their father, so to speak, but to be a helper of their mothers. And it wasn't a totally bad decision. I got a great blessing from my mother. At the same time, by receiving that blessing, you really find yourself cut off from almost all other men. And I think a lot of men in my situation find that they have to go back and sort of rewrite that contract with the mother. Not with anger, but just saying that, I fulfilled as much as I could with that contract. I tried to help you as much as I could. I took in as much of your suffering and pain as I could, and I have to recognize that I did not save you. And now it's time to feel and go back to find a place inside the masculine world. Does that make sense to you?
Well, on some level it does. On some level, I don't understand it. So maybe we can explore that a little
bit. What don't you understand about it?
Well, the sense almost that if you're close to your mother, that there's no place for you in the male world. And that somehow by identifying with your mother, that you not only lost the relationship with your father, but you lost your sense of yourself as male, and that somehow maybe it's your mother who's to blame.
No, I don't think, I think you'd make a mistake here if you go into blame. I think something like this will make it clear. We were in San Francisco, there were maybe 1,000 men there. One man got up in the middle and said, you know, for the last 15 years, I have been a substitute, a husband, and a companion, and a lover for my mother. And I said to him, how do you feel about men? He said, I don't trust them. So we're talking about a situation here in which the women, oftentimes particularly single mothers, have so much financial grief, so much soul grief, feel so abandoned that they move towards the son rather than the husband. And I don't think that's wicked on their side either. It's just what happens. And then sometimes they'll tell the young son, you know, your father was unreliable, all men are unreliable. And that's why he said at that moment, I don't trust men.
You write that men have to have a strong father and a strong male mentor as well, because there are things that a woman just can't provide. You write, even the best-intentioned women cannot give what is needed to a son. What is it, do you think, that a son can only get from a father or from a male mentor and that a mother can't provide?
Well, you know, that's an explosive idea. I mean, the whole situation. One of the things that surprised me in the response to the men's movement is that women often come down to this point, we don't want the men interfering with the growing up of the son. But the question is, why would we assume that a mother could do everything for a boy? Why is it a tradition in the past that the father and the mentor try to do as much as they can? So I'll try to answer that with a little metaphor. You know, the new work on brain research and the development of the fetus is very solid. And the general conclusion is that all fetuses in the womb are female. And about the sixth week, tremendous amount of orders come in from the DNA to change the female fetus, the body and the brain and the muscle system and so on, into what we think of as the male version, so that the upper torso is changed, some of the bones are lengthened, some of the vulva skin is turned and changed into the testicle sac, and the clitoris is enlarged, becomes a penis. All of those things happen. So you can say that by the time the boy comes out of the womb, he's a nervous wreck because of the number of changes that have taken place. So the question is then, you can say that men are experimental species. The women are the basic species, and men are experimental. So the question is then, is the fetus completely turned into the male by the time it comes out of the womb? And the answer, I would think, is no. Because he's only about half finished. And what initiation means for men is that when the boy comes out, he is still partly with the mother. He's with the mother 2 or 3 years. He feels this resistance oftentimes. You see a 5-year-old boy sitting with his mother, and he tries to break out of her lap and leave and so on. That doesn't mean that there's anything she's doing wrong. It means that he is trying to proceed farther along this strange path towards something unknown. What is an adult male really look like? What is it? And so the older males in the old tribes then come in, and they try to help him move farther along that path.
You'll forgive me, but this whole thing about the womb and how it starts as a female and ends up as a male, and the male is kind of unformed and has undergone trauma by the time he's born, sounds a little far-fetched to me in terms of a theory for the men's movement, you know what I mean, in terms of an explanation of the male psyche or something.
Well, you know, there's a good book. A lot of this work has been done by women, one of them in Boston University. Read a book called Sex in the Brain. It should have been called Sex Differences in the Brain. But this is not an explanation of the men's movement. The men's movement would be in existence whether this happened or not. The men's movement primarily, in my opinion, has to do with the increasing distance between father and son. And that happens in the industrial culture because the father's out of the house. So I'm simply, I mean, you're asking me a question as to why male influence would be necessary. I'm trying to give you a metaphorical answer, which is that when the woman comes out of the womb, there is something there that's sweet and whole, and she goes through a tremendous amount of suffering after that. But it's as if her mother teaches her by example what a fully grown woman is. But I'm trying to explain that my feeling is that the boy, 5 years old, 6 years old, seven, hasn't the vaguest idea what it is to be a man.
Well, here's something I want to bring up with you that's related. You write that men have become more in touch with their feminine side, they've become more thoughtful, more gentle, but that process hasn't made them more free. You write, you know, a man could be a nice boy who pleases not only his mother, but also the young woman he's living with, but that can make him a softer male with little vitality to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how far that is from the stereotype that a feminized man is soft, that a man who hangs around the mother too much or women too much becomes soft, that femininity is soft and therefore bad for a man to be around. I guess, you know, this whole kind of genderizing of characteristics, certain characteristics are male, certain characteristics are female, that always makes me uncomfortable because it makes me feel like, well, as a woman, I have to conform to these certain things. That's, I mean, for women, that's always been used against us.
I understand that. And Deborah Tannen, when she talks, always says, now, we're not talking here of categories in which you fit. We're talking about generalities on each side of the thing, like north and south. And there are some women who have more yang energy in them than men do. And there are certain men who have more yin and feminine energy than certain women do. So I think the danger is to be afraid that it'll be a category which will again diminish the value and self-respect of women. But on the other hand, the attempt to bring up, or the attempt to deny all gender differences hasn't worked well either.
No, here's something that I see as a kind of fundamental difference between how the women's movement and how the men's movement have gone about understanding gender. And mm-hmm. you might really disagree with me on this, mm-hmm. but it seems to me the women's movement has basically said, let's challenge all the gender preconceptions, all the gender stereotypes. Just because you're born a woman doesn't mean that you have to be, you know, a nurturing, soft, all the kind of gender stereotypes about what a woman is. And therefore, just because you're a man doesn't mean you have to be the macho, whatever.
Yes.
We can both share in the parenting. We could both go out and get mm-hmm. jobs. And I think the women's movement developed a language that challenged gender preconceptions. And I guess I worry a little bit that the men's movement has developed a language that is reinforcing the gender preconceptions by really using the words like feminine and masculine and warrior and stuff like that a lot.
Yeah, I feel very different than the way you feel. I know that there's always a tremendous danger in using any word like warrior. And in the Iron John, I talk about it primarily as the inner warrior, the one who protects you from shame. We're not talking about the warrior as the aggressor. So what I feel is going on is that we, too, are challenging these things, that the typical gender division for men is that they go out and they become violent, they finish their task, they work 14 hours a day for a corporation, they never admit weakness. What we're talking about by bringing poetry in and by bringing in night work and all kinds of relationships to soul and to weeping, sometimes in the middle of a 1 week men's conference, by the third or fourth day, when we bring up the father material, there will be 60 of the 80 men weeping, and they'll sometimes weep for an hour or two. One time I went into a room after a group of men had been there, and what I could smell was the smell of tears in the whole room 2 hours later. So I want to mention to you how much that violates the gender characteristics that most of those men have inherited.
My guest is Robert Bly, a founder of the men's movement. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Bly, and his book Iron John has just come out in paperback. Iron John is kind of built around a fairy tale, as I recall, Grimm's fairy tale.
Well, it's one that the Grimm brothers took.
Yeah, right. And so a lot of the book is spent kind of explaining this story and using it kind of mythically to discuss your larger thoughts about men and women and the men's movement. I guess I'm a little bit uncomfortable using a fairy tale as the basis to understanding gender, only because I feel like if I really used a lot of fairy tales to understand what it's like to be a woman, I'd probably be in a coma waiting for a prince to come along and kiss me. Do you know what I mean?
That's been talked about a lot, and I know that what I would say to you in that situation is that the danger is in taking a fairy tale literally. You know, Americans are not good on metaphorical thinking, as Bush proves again and again.
Well, I'm used to metaphorical thinking, though.
But you see, when there is a woman in a fairy tale, it is not literally a woman. The one who waits is the feminine part either of the man or the woman, or the waiting part of the man or the woman.
See, but you did it again. The one who waits is the feminine part.
That's
why
the one who's described in
you?
The fairy tales.
Yeah, but you see what I mean? Are you kind of like genderizing certain characteristics as being female, waiting, patience?
Right, we're doing that. And that's what Debutante is doing, too. The one waits while other people speak. And she says, learn the other way. Learn that part of yourself, which is described in the fairy tale, as a prince who goes out and does something in the woods. So therefore, if you understand that inside a woman there's a man and a woman, and inside a woman there's a man and a woman, if there's four when there are a man and a woman together, then what the woman is asked to do, which is exactly what the women's movement have asked women to do, go out into the world like a prince, get your horse, go on out there, decide what you want to do, and do it. Now, that instruction also comes through the fairy tales.
Yeah, but again, I mean, you're just dividing all kind of traits as being male and female, and I should add that in the Iron John story, when the young man has to steal the key to the cage from under his mother's pillow, you're seeing that as the mother, not some kind of metaphor for a certain type of personality trait. You know, in your telling of the story, you're talking about men and women, male and female. You don't see it as that kind of metaphor.
Well, usually when I'm trying to do Iron John, I try to run it through two or three times. And the first time you do it in a literal way, the second time you do it in the more metaphorical way. I know Gioia Timpanelli was telling me one time, the time to get the key from under your mother's pillow is a day when your mother and father are absent. What does that mean? Well, she said, on certain days, in your head, your internalized mother and your internalized father will not be there. That's the day to get it. So we're talking here not only of the physical mother, but of the way we internalize our parents. And that's also suggested by getting the key out. But I'm agreeing with you when I say that whenever you use fairy tales, it's very, very difficult because some of the fairy tales come from a time when the gender things were laid out in a way that they didn't allow any sort of division from. And at the same time, some of it comes from a spiritual teaching in which the feminine and masculine are considered as simple, different parts of each psyche. But then you have to look at what the alternative is. One of the things I think that... What is the alternative? Sociology? In other words, you cannot move human beings by using completely degenderized, completely abstract words. Sociology has failed completely, in my opinion, in talking about the men's movement, which is something I know about. I don't know about its work with the women's movement. Why do we have poetry? Because poetry penetrates down to the deepest levels of the psyche, where feminine and masculine still exist and where movements can be made back and forth. Sociological language, abstract language, academic language, often philosophical language, can be sanitized, but no one ever wants to change after hearing it. It doesn't penetrate deeply enough. So I'm saying the same thing here, that it's dangerous to do the fairy tales. It's more dangerous to put the language in the hands of sociologists and let them try to do it.
Well, let me pick up on what you're saying.
Yep.
Because a lot of the myths and stories that you're drawing on are either fairy tales or they're from tribal cultures, from indigenous cultures of centuries and centuries ago. Both of those kinds of stories are drawn from times or drawn from cultures in which there was a much more, I think, rigid sense of what a man does and what a woman does. The fairy tales come from an era of kings and queens, a kind of pre-egalitarian, pre-democratic era, and certainly a pre-feminist era. And I'm just suggesting that it's possible that those stories might really serve to reinforce gender
stereotypes. I agree with you. What do you suggest doing? In other words, I agree with you. And when a fairy storyteller tells a story, it's important for him to put in those things that you're saying. But does that mean you abandon that literature completely?
No, but you're using it as kind of like the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's the clearest thing that I've ever heard about the development of the male soul from the child onward. And if you're going to throw away that, then you're going to have to throw away the Vedas. I think the stories that have been preserved by memory in Europe are older than the Vedas. They're the oldest literature that we have. And I think it's very dangerous to say that all of this literature should be thrown away because there's dangers to men or women when you use it.
But I have to say, though, having read your book and also watched the Bill Moyer special with you from a couple of years ago,
yeah,
I'm not sure that you've really taken those stories and put them into a context that takes into account sexism and racism, class issues. I mean, do you feel
that you've put it
into a kind of social and political context?
No, I think that's true. I didn't cover everything in that book. And I think it's also true that there wasn't enough attention in Iron John to economic situations involving women and men and to class issues involving women and men. I agree with that.
Okay. You have become an important figure to many men. You've become almost like a father figure to them and almost like a spiritual leader to them. And some people have even used the word guru, which is
a word.
Yeah, I know that you do. I know that you do. But do you ever fear that you're in danger of being seen that way by men in the movement? And do you feel that you have to take certain precautions to, A, not let your ego get too big, and B, to not let people see you in a more powerful way than you think is appropriate for you to be seen?
Yeah, I think that's quite right, and I have to try to do that every day. If I don't, I'm finished. But I also take the precaution this year, for example, of doing no teaching in the men's thing at all. I'm spending the whole year really in bed reading books and simply refusing all sorts of engagements. So that helps me to make them understand that I'm happy to be a father figure to some of them, but it doesn't mean that I give up my private life.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed the conversation a lot.
Robert Bly, his book about men, Iron John, has just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the roots of the conflict between Koreans and blacks in Los Angeles. We talk with John Lee, a Korean-American journalist who writes for the Los Angeles Times. Also, New York in the 50s. Jack Kerouac, Dylan Thomas, James Baldwin, and Joan Didion were there. Dan Wakefield was a struggling freelance writer at the time. Now he's written a memoir of the decade. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has announced that he will attend an Earth Summit conference next month in Brazil. This meeting is sponsored by the UN, and Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali was a visitor today at the White House. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The announcement came as the president prepared to meet with Boutros-Ghali and Maurice Strong, Secretary General, for the Rio conference.
I think that we have a big stake. I take great pride in the fact that in many ways the U.S. has been a leader for environmental matters. I'm convinced that we can have jobs and economic growth as well as sound economic environmental practice, and I will be taking the U.S. message to Rio.
The Rio conference will be attended by representatives from 160 nations, including 60 heads of state, gathered to sign an international agreement on climate change. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Voters are going to the polls in West Virginia, where President Bush and Governor Bill Clinton appear headed for easy victories. However, there's a hard-fought race for the Democratic nomination for governor and for a newly formed congressional district, where two U.S. congressmen are pitted against each other. In the state of Nebraska, officials say that voting in today's primary so far has been light. Along with the presidential primary, there are other ballot considerations to be decided. Mike DeMott reports from Omaha.
Election officials say people are going to the polls mostly to vote on Amendment 1, a measure that would give the legislature broad authority to decide which personal property is taxed. Nebraskans were excited about the presidential race up until March 5th. That's the day Democratic Senator Bob Kerrey stopped his campaign for the White House. Officials project that of the state's 800,000 registered voters, only about 38% will cast ballots. One poll predicts President Bush will win big over Pat Buchanan and that Bill Clinton will easily defeat Jerry Brown. Low turnout reflects voters' lack of enthusiasm for candidates who have largely ignored the state. Of all the contenders, Jerry Brown has campaigned here most. One of Nebraska's most exciting primaries was in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy's campaign won an important victory here. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike DeMott in Omaha.
After a meeting today at the White House, Democratic congressional leaders said both parties will work together to try and aid the nation's inner cities. However, House Speaker Foley and Senate Democratic Leader Mitchell said that there had been no agreement with President Bush on how to fund a program to encourage investment and create jobs for inner cities, along with getting rid of crime and drugs. Foley said that Mr. Bush had indicated a willingness to compromise, and there had been pledges to work together. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 12 points to close at 3,385.12 on volume of 193 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 10 to 7. This is NPR News. Because of continued heavy fighting, the European community has pulled its last observers out of Bosnia. EC officials said the ethnic violence had made their mission too dangerous. Meanwhile, the U.S. says it will do the same as the EC and pull its diplomats out of Belgrade as a protest of Serbian aggression against Bosnia. Since votes for independence nearly 3 months ago, more than 1,300 people have been killed in Bosnia. Serbian factions are opposed to independence and are backed by the Serbian-led Federal Army. And delegates to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe have ruled against members of the Yugoslav delegation having any say-so in matters concerning Bosnia. German Chancellor Kohl says that Germany's armed forces should take part in multilateral troop actions to maintain international security. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Germany must accept its new international responsibilities, which includes military participation in all UN-sponsored peacekeeping and military missions, according to Chancellor Helmut Kohl. There's been heated public debate in Germany since the Gulf War about the deployment of German troops on UN missions outside of NATO territory. The Bonn government wants to change the constitutional clause that restricts German troops to the defense of NATO territory, but the government coalition lacks the support of the opposition for such a constitutional change. Kohl made his comments at the annual German commanders meeting in Leipzig, where commanders told officers to stop babying recruits and to try and raise sagging morale among the soldiers. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In New York City, U.N. Secretary General Boutros Ghali says the cost of a peacekeeping mission to Cambodia will come to $1.7 billion by the end of July 1993. At that time, Cambodia is to hold national elections for a new government. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the many issues the Los Angeles riots brought to the attention of the nation was the tension between African Americans and Koreans. Many Korean-owned businesses were targeted by looters and arsonists. With no police to protect them, some Korean merchants defended themselves with guns. My guest John Lee has been covering Black Korean conflicts in Los Angeles for the LA Times. He's been with the Times for 6 years, and before that wrote for the Korea Times. His parents emigrated to America from Korea in 1954. Lee was born in California. He told me that the riots took a spiritual as well as a financial toll on the Korean community.
I think the Koreans who were hit, the businesses and the owners who were hit by the rioting, many of them don't understand the context in which these riots came out. Many of them have been in this country less than 10 years, and their knowledge of American history may be limited because they were raised and schooled in Korea. So they're coming into Los Angeles with little background on tension that pre-existed, and to become the target of what has been described as a racial outbreak, economic clash, is very difficult for them to come to terms with, because they don't really understand what it is that they're being attacked for.
John, I'm wondering if you feel the rioting took a personal toll on you in a way. I'm wondering about the divisions that you might have felt. I suspect you have friends in the African American community as well as in the Korean community. And I wonder if you're feeling torn at all and feeling like both sides have misunderstood each other.
Yeah, but Terry, that goes back for years. I've been covering what has been described as this Black Korean conflict for about 6 years, and from the beginning, there the same differences that are being described now have existed, and it's more a kind of confirmation that these are very important issues that should have been addressed before the boiling point had been reached.
John, I wonder if you've ever been in a Korean-run store at a time when there's been African-American customers in the store, and you've seen a misunderstanding happen, and you felt that you understood how the Korean shop owner and the African-American customer were misreading each other's cues, and in a way, by doing it, reinforcing each other's stereotypes. Is there an incident like that you could tell us?
I can, but in doing so, I'd just like to say that this is one of the very minor incidences that really is more a symptom rather mm-hmm. than a cause for racial tension
right.
Among Koreans and African Americans. But something as simple as placing change on the counter rather than placing it in the customer's hand. It's not limited to Koreans, but in Korea, that's very common practice to put the money on the counter because of some very kind of Confucian, almost Victorian moral values that or restraints on behavior. Physical contact between male and female in that kind of situation might be frowned upon in very strict Confucian sense. And it's not uncommon for a woman merchant to place the money on the counter when there's a male customer, just to avoid that physical contact.
Even and if I the customer is holding out his hand, waiting for the change.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's been the case. And in the case that I've observed, I did see a tinge of irritation on the face of the customer when he clearly was holding out his hand and the money was placed on the counter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done so without eye contact. It wasn't done with any kind of maliciousness on behalf of the merchant, but I know it was perceived as a disrespect, an act of disrespect. And to observe that and perhaps multiply it by hundreds of incidences that one person may go through in the course of a few years, you can imagine what kind of frustration builds up and what kind of feeling of hatred could build up over these minor slights.
I wonder if you think that many Koreans who have come to this country in the past few years have street smarts. And by that I mean, I think to run any store in an urban neighborhood, you have to really be able to tell the difference between a boast and a threat. And you have mm-hmm. to tell the difference between someone who comes in and maybe looks tough but really isn't going to be dangerous and someone who walks in and looks tough and in fact might rob your store in a minute or assault you. And these are judgment calls that you have to make all the time when you're in an urban neighborhood in which there is a lot of crime. And do you think it's hard for people from another country, particularly from a Korean culture, to come in and understand the cues? You know?
Clearly. I think you can ask native-born U.S. citizens here, put them on the street in an area that they're not familiar with, and they'll tell you that they're at a loss for how to interact with people. I've seen it in our reporting staff, which, if you can imagine, that there are certain areas of the city where it's expected reporters of color are sent regularly to cover the news that goes in there. And it's because this perception that reporters of color are going to have some better sense of how to deal with the people in those communities.
My guest is Korean-American journalist John Lee. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Lee, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Do African Americans from the neighborhood work in Korean-owned businesses very often?
No, not very often. There are some cases. I think Koreans have. It's been called to Korean merchants' attention that this is one of the sources of resentment that Koreans will not employ African Americans, and I know that in recent years there's been an effort to hire some of the residents in the communities that these businesses are in.
Who are they hiring? Are they hiring other Koreans, family members, or white people?
The smallest stores employ. Usually, they won't employ people outside of the family simply because they don't have the money to pay them. In other cases where the businesses are a little larger and they do require stocking people or people outside of the family, I know that there has been a tendency to hire Latinos, some of the immigrant Latinos who live in those neighborhoods also. And I think that's out of a sense of identification with somebody who's going through an immigrant experience and who might not be at a language advantage.
Mm-hmm.
I know many Korean merchants have expressed to me the difficulty in hiring an African American youth who is very, it's very wise in the ways of the neighborhood, and has language facility, and is put in a position of having to take orders from a merchant who can barely communicate in English. It's one of the factors that makes it a difficult relationship between African American employee and Korean American merchant. But I know merchants are beginning to see that you know those inconveniences or those awkward situations have to be overcome, and that the issue of returning African American dollars to the community, money that's spent by African Americans, should be returned to the community. I know that merchants are slowly coming to see that's a very important issue.
Now, I know a lot of African Americans said that it wasn't just the Rodney King verdict that was upsetting. It was an earlier verdict in a case where a Korean store owner killed a 15-year-old customer named Latasha Harlins after the store owner thought that the customer was shoplifting a container of orange juice. And the store owner got 5 years probation.
It was first-degree manslaughter that she was convicted of.
Well, what was the reaction? I know for many African Americans, they were really angry at the verdict. What was the reaction within the Korean community to that verdict?
I think that was one of the most underreported stories in the mainstream, is that Koreans did not, while Koreans may have identified with this merchant's struggle before the incident took place, many Koreans condemned the sentencing because they felt that the merchant had been convicted of first degree manslaughter, and as did African Americans, many felt that the judge had effectively overruled what the jury's decision. And I think that many Korean merchants felt that the legal system had once again shortchanged African Americans, and that the Korean merchant was going to be depicted as characteristic of all Korean merchants, and I think that there was a feeling that this was a very extraordinary case, and mm-hmm. that there was some attempt on Korean Americans, a very concerted effort to show that they felt that the legal system had failed the girl's family.
Now, I know you grew up in San Diego, but your parents would sometimes bring you to Los Angeles to shop in Koreatown there. Mm-hmm. Are any of the stores that you remember from your childhood still around now, and are they still standing after the rioting?
The riots affected many businesses, but still, Koreatown is a very densely populated area with businesses. So it's not like all of Koreatown fell to the rioting. But are you referring to the Olympic Market?
Sure.
Uh-huh. The Olympic Market was one of the first markets, if not the first Korean market in Los Angeles. And it burned down accidentally maybe 3 years ago. And at that time, there was a real sense of loss that people who shopped at Olympic felt. It was like the passing of a friend. And I think in looking at the burned out businesses in Koreatown now, it's a similar feeling that, you know, an era has passed. Koreatown was very prosperous since the late 70s through the 80s. Many businesses opened, and to see those, you know, more than 1,800 businesses burned or looted throughout the city, there's a feeling that there's a collective sense of loss, I think, that every Korean in Los Angeles feels.
As a Korean American journalist, What would you most like to be writing about now? What do you want to bring to the ongoing understanding of this story?
I believe the Koreans have been posed as an active agent in the racial tension that led to the outbursts. From a Korean's perspective, Koreans have operated according to the laws and the practices of this country. Perhaps in their success, they've been held up. From one side, they've been held up as an example of the consummate business person or immigrant.
Enterprising, right.
Enterprising, industrious, devoted, self-exploitive almost, and successful. And when you hold that image up next to a fourth-generation African-American in this country who has seen nothing but roadblocks set up in front of him or her, suddenly that image of the consummate immigrant business person becomes a target. And I don't think it's the Korean immigrant who put themselves in that position. I think that's something that society as a whole, that the media has placed, that's a position that the media has placed the immigrant in. And from my own observation, I wonder, you know, why is that? Why do we have this model minority? Why do we have these images? And from what happened in these riots, it seems almost insidious that society will allow immigrants and African Americans to exist in these low income areas with this business customer relationship, and as long as they fight with each other, there's a sense of, oh, this is intractable racial problem. And I think in a sense it may be comforting to know that African Americans have racial problems with other ethnic groups, and I think in a sense it relieves some of the burden of a largely white dominated society that has placed African Americans in clearly a position of being discriminated against.
John Lee, he's a Korean-American reporter. He writes for the Los Angeles Times. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We'll be hearing today about President Bush's proposals for an urban policy. One of those, this is all, of course, following the riots in Los Angeles, is to introduce there the Weed and Seed program. Weed out drug dealers, seed inner-city neighborhoods with social agencies and economic opportunities. We'll hear a little bit of how that has worked in one New Jersey city. We will also be hearing about the elections for president in the Philippines and why the counting of the votes takes so long there. Also, what to expect from the Rio conference on the environment and how the United States went bankrupt, how we increased the budget deficit by so much.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Dan Wakefield moved to New York City the year Dwight Eisenhower was elected president. He left the year John Kennedy was assassinated. A list of his cohorts during that time reads like a who's who of the best, the brightest, and the hippest. His new memoir about that time is called New York in the 50s. John Leonard has this review.
Whatever we've done, says Dan Wakefield of himself and his friends, was shaped by the fortunate fact that we started out in the most exciting city of its era, a Mecca that, like Paris in the 1920s, exists now only in memory. Its naming now seems legendary, New York in the 50s. Wakefield, wanting to be a writer, left boring Indiana for tumultuous New York by train in 1952. And everybody he met in the big city was either already famous or so eager they'd eventually become so. In the classroom at Columbia, he got Mark Van Dorn and Lionel Trilling for English literature and composition, and C. Wright Mills for politics. At the West End Bar, he got Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, drummers with a different beat. In Greenwich Village, he got Norman Mailer, James Baldwin, Michael Harrington, and Murray Kempton. At the White Horse, novelists and journalists. At the Cedar Tavern, abstract expressionists. On the Bowery, he got Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker intellectuals. At magazines like The Nation and Commonweal, he got the space to write his meticulous and humane sort of journalism, including a brilliant report from Mississippi on the murder of Emmett Till. At Esquire, he got some serious money. In Spanish Harlem, he got material for his first book, Island in the City. Young Wakefield would befriend an equally young Norman Podhoretz, Joan Didion, William Styron, Lorraine Hansberry, and William F. Buckley, Jr. He would write books about the anti-war movement and a television soap opera and five novels. He would move to Boston. But he never forgot being young in New York. And he returns in this memoir to celebrate not only his friends and the community they made and the city that sustained them, but to relive as well, with enormous affection, such 50s obsessions as jazz, which he has always preferred to rock and roll, and psychoanalysis, which seems to have done him more harm than good, and J.D. Salinger, whose Franny and Zooey get more attention than they deserve, not to mention such wonders of the age as yogurt and the diaphragm. It's hard to imagine a remembrance more congenial, so graceful, so immune to grudge, so seasoned throughout with the equally vivid recollections of his friends, who seem as mystified as Wakefield is that such a New York no longer exists, that we have restaurants and bunkers and battle stations instead of communities, that we have television sets instead of camaraderie. Part of the problem, I suspect, is that everybody's a lot older, into jobs and marriages that keep them out of the bohemian bars and the little magazines that pay even less. And part of the problem may be that young people can't afford to live anymore in Manhattan, where they might have found their own communities of energy and talent. And part of the problem may be that few of us have Wakefield's remarkable gift for friendship. But most of the problem probably is that the age we live in has coarsened everybody, and the feelings that arise from its brutal events are either prepackaged and disposable or numb and misshapen. Would Wakefield himself return, like his friend Joan Didion? I don't think I'd have the guts and courage and money, he says. But, well, maybe I could go back for just a little while. Alas, Dan, the city really needs you, a friend, and some decency.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Dan Wakefield's new memoir, New York in the 50s. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Turning Right. Chief Justice William Rehnquist once considered retirement after so many years as the lone conservative on the Supreme Court. But in the last decade, four conservative justices were appointed. We'll talk with journalist David Savage, author of a new book on the making of the Rehnquist Court. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.